Is the version, is this okay?
Yeah. I didn't know if you had a.
Yeah.
The mic is actually.
Well, we're gonna make that there. Right, so the second session, this workshop, our charge was to talk about international network, multi-messenger astronomy, so collaborations internationally and with the astronomy community in the near term. So we have, together with Giovanni and Tarun and Shinji, we have come up with this layout. We're going to have two talks on the status fossil one, core prediction of sources, rate localization by Leo, then observing scenarios by Lisa, then it's going to be a break, and then we're going to have a panel discussion that Giovanni will lead, and that's for the international cooperation side of things. And then we're going to move on to multi-messenger and the end follow-up with a talk by Peter, and then a review, like another panel discussion to follow. So that should take us to 6 p.m. Hopefully we'll be able to fit this all. So the first talk is from Leo, who's going to tell us about the status of fossil one, the sources, rate, and localization. Just give me a second to move the team page.
Cool. Lara, I just realized that the green is on this computer. Is just, did I get it?
Yeah, because we're shooting the screen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, B2. There's a B3.
Oh, okay. I'm holding in lunch break.
Yeah, yeah.
Large files, take a while to download.
Yeah.
It's not going to be Andromax. Must take a while.
Should I just start with my computer?
Yeah, okay. Well, in that case, we need to. This is not downloading right. Let's just change that. And then,
if you were able to download it, you could.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. There we go. Okay. All right, great. So, sorry about the mishap with the slides. I just wanted to thank Laura for asking me to come and give this talk. I'm going to be saying some fairly obvious, maybe self-evident things about localization in three detectors mostly. But the organization of my talk will be that I will remind you of why we are so interested in neutron star binaries as well as binary black holes. I'll review what we know about the rates for all three types of binaries, and then I'll talk about localization over the next few years. So first of all, of course, binary black holes, we all know this. We had our first light event this past fall, and we found this fabulous event, PW15913, enough said here. But
the reason that we're so interested in neutron star binaries is that in a neutron star binary merger, there's going to be matter involved, and that matter can fuel a variety of different types of electromagnetic counterparts, including a gamma ray burst, a so-called R-process kilonova, and using all of these signatures and looking for all of these signatures in different wavelengths, we can test whether these compact binary mergers are indeed the mechanism behind short gamma ray bursts. We can pinpoint the host galaxy and learn in detail about the environment in which the binary formed. We can do cosmology using the standard science approach. And the thing that people have been very excited about lately is that we can likely explain the cosmic abundance of heavy R-process elements. So those are the main reasons why we have an EM follow-up effort that involves a collaboration with a huge number of different facilities on the ground and in space, in optical, infrared, radio, and gamma ray and X-ray wavelengths. We did follow up the first of these, the first several of these compact binaries. Didn't find anything in the optical, although there's the famous Fermi GBM interest that has everyone scratching their heads. So there are a bunch of highlights from the observing campaign that was done in 01. We did promptly localize a number of actual gravitational sources, although there were delays in sending them out, unfortunately. There was a detection of a possible gamma ray transient by Fermi GBM, follow-up of nearby galaxies with Swift XRT, some interesting science with DECAM searching for failed supernovae in the Large Magellanic Cloud, and a bunch of papers that have come out about the efforts that all of these different facilities on the ground and in space have done. So what we learned about rates is that we can take the live time that we achieved in the few weeks surrounding GBL-59914 and extrapolate forward in time. And we can also take just all of the events that we detect in 01 and predict the probability that we'll see a given number of events by the end of 02 or by the end of 03. This plot, which probably everyone in this room has seen, but I'll just remind you how to interpret it, shows the probability that you detect 10 or more, 35 or more, or 70 or more events by the end of after having accumulated a given amount of volume times time. And these solid bars represent the range of space-time volumes that we might be able to achieve in 02 and 03. So the takeaway from this is that we'll have order of 10 events by the end of 02, an order of 10 to 100 stellar mass binary black hole events by the end of 03. The story for neutron star binaries, which include both binary neutron stars and neutron star black holes, still is basically unchanged from the last revision of the observing scenarios document. So if you just take the rates in the 2010 LIGO rates paper and fold that through the projected sensitivity curves, we should have either detections or interesting constraints on rates for both neutron star black hole and binary neutron star mergers by 02 or 03. The last topic that I was asked to speak about is localization. And so I'm going to present some new, but hopefully intuitive and not too surprising results on the subject of localization with three detectors, which is where we want to go as quickly as we can. So the commissioning timetables of Virgo, Kagra, and LIGO India are out of phase with LIGOs. That's been explained in numerous talks, and see Lisa Barsavi's talk after mine for lots of detail about that. So as a result, we're going to experience a transition from a two detector network to a three detector network. And the detection rate is, for a time, going to be driven by the two most sensitive detectors, but the sky localization is going to be driven by the third detector. And transitions like this could occur in the future, especially with when we began commissioning third generation detectors. So the impact on a given event depends on where it is in the sky and also on the signal to noise ratio. But the average or typical localization that you expect depends on the ratio of sensitivity between the two most sensitive detectors and the third detector. And so the question I wanted to answer is, what does this transition look like? At what ratio does this threshold occur? And is it a very sharp transition, or is it a very smooth transition as the third detector ramps up in sensitivity? So, as a sort of toy, we can take the localization of GW-1509-14, and we can simulate, for instance, transforming it into a binary neutron star with the same signal-to-noise ratio. This demonstrates the impact that masses have on sky localization, because you're picking up you're weighting the noise sensitivity curve differently. As you go from binary black hole to neutron star black hole to neutron star neutron star, the sky localization for sources at the same SNR but different distances, of course, improved by about a factor of two. So that's just a rule of thumb that we can keep in mind. But then if we turn on advanced Virgo at the early sensitivity that's in the observing scenarios document, then the localization of GW-1509-14 would shrink from hundreds of square degrees to tens of square degrees. So if we look at all three of the events, all two and a half events that we've detected so far, and we play the same trick, Boxing Day event and the subprime LBT 15, 10, 12 trigger are not impacted quite as much because they're both lower SNR and they're in different places on the sky, and this depends a lot on sky on where you are in the sky. So I did a little sensitivity study where I took the Virgo noise curve and I moved it up and down. The summary of this, if you're bored by now and zoning out, is that if Virgo's range is only a quarter of LIGO's at any given time, then still having that third detector shrinks our localizations to, oh, I'm sorry, that should be 50% of their size when we have only two detectors. So if you assume that you have a binary neutron star range of 81 megaparsecs, which is about what we achieved in 01, and also consistent with mid-low curve from the observing scenarios document, and then assume a baseline binary neutron star merger range for Virgo of about 21 megaparsecs, and then scale it up and down, you'll see this transition occur. This is the model Hanford-Livingston noise curve that I use in blue, and in these different shades of magenta are the variations on that Virgo noise curve. The one that's outlined in gray is the baseline 21 megaparsecs noise curve. So I'm varying the range of Virgo from about 2% of LIGO's range to 80 megaparsecs, the same as LIGO's range. This is what that looks like for a single event. This is a fairly typical event. So the localization starts out looking like these double banana shapes that are familiar to us from GW-1512-26 and LBT-1510-12, and they shrink down to a nice compact single island when you have three equally sensitive detectors, and there is a smooth transition. Having a third detector has very little impact on detection rate or range, and that's borne out here. So this is a violin plot. It's just a density plot on its side. So each of these vertical lines corresponds to a different configuration of Virgo, and the label here is the logarithm base 10 of the ratio of the range compared to the baseline range that I put in. These black solid lines here are basically box plots, and so you can see that the distribution of distances that you get has a median that stays pretty much fixed to the nominal LIGO range. There is a very, very slight uptick as you ramp up Virgo sensitivity, but it's very, very minor.
I mean, until it gets to be the same sensitivity.
Well, that's right. But still, you can. It's not. So you really have to be at equal sensitivity, and even then, it's not like a factor of two improvement or anything like that.
It looks like it's about a factor of 2 degrees.
Oh, maybe in range, not in range though. So these are the same sorts of violin plots. These are distributions of 90% credible area on the sky. This is representative of where we were in 01, and this is representative of where we'd be with three equally sensitive detectors. We go from a median area on the sky of about 700 square degrees down to a few tens of square degrees. This baseline configuration here, which has Virgo having a range of 1/4 of LIGO, still you see an improvement in the median area by about a factor of 60%. So the conclusions of this study are, I think, intuitive, maybe obvious, but I think it's helpful to see them borne out quantitatively anyway. So we expect to have order of 10 binary black holes by the end of 02, up to almost 100 by the end of 03, and detections and meaningful limits for neutron star binaries by the end of 02 or 03. The detection rate is going to be set by the range of the second most sensitive detector. That's because we require coincidence. This is an adage that's sort of in the lore of the compact binary coalescence group. And I'd like to add to it an adage of my own that accurate sky localization is achieved by maximizing the range of the third most sensitive detector. And therefore, localization will begin improving dramatically once a third detector is at least 1/4 as sensitive as LHO and LLO, and you can insert any other pair of detectors there, and the exact threshold will change, but the basic conclusion is still going to hold. And I'll stop there and ask the questions. Thank you.
This last project was extremely useful because we wanted to understand when Virgo can really make a big difference, and that's really a very important number. I wanted to ask you whether in your code you do include polarization effects as well.
Yep.
And that should then help us break the degeneracy between the distance and orientation and polarization, all three are related. So you got extra slides. That's good.
Yeah,
you have another comment, but next slide.
Yeah, actually, it only helps a little bit. So, and this is something I just made this morning after Peter's question from Salvo's talk. It turns out that the distance accuracy, which is what you're getting at with breaking the luminosity inclination degeneracy by measuring both polarizations. It turns out that you only get the distance uncertainty decreases by only about a factor of 0.7.
I think if you can repeat that for LIGO media application, you'll find that it's a lot better because it's a three-dimensional volume that is filled by something like LIGO media as opposed to what both is roughly the same volume.
Yes, that's right. At, so going to four detectors, or even taking out LIGO Hanford and replacing it with LIGO India, so if you have three detectors that have very dissimilar home credit patterns, it's going to break those patterns. You can actually, oh, yeah.
Go ahead, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, I'm just beating a dead horse here. But this is sort of what happens as you gradually turn on Vance Virgo to the localizations in two dimensions. So you go from these sort of big pancakey blobs down to a sort of spindle, but the depth of this spindle, which is basically set by the generosity of consistency information, which is not helped by it's not severely affected with this particular combination.
I wanted to go back and touch upon something that you mentioned about the distance reach when you add a new detector. The reason why that doesn't happen is, of course, because these detectors are looking at different parts of the sky, as it were. But what really happens is the completeness of the survey, which is what astronomers worry a lot, becomes better and better. The horizon remains roughly the same, but we begin to see 90% of the sources within a certain distance instead of only 50% or 30%. And that's tremendously important for astronomy because it removes things like Mankiw's bias and so on. So it is an important addition, even though the distance reach is
for sure.
Thank you.
Stefan?
Yeah, thanks.
I guess in all those studies, we should make a distinction of the whole sample sources that are detectable versus the solid. Because things like optimization are very different from the solid as well. And I might guess that a lot of the science are different from the solid.
Yes, that's right. So that's why I was careful to show box plots here as well, so that you can see, you know, what are the best localizations to do, and what are the worst localizations to do? And that varies a little bit. I don't have numbers in my head. That's right.
Do you have a sense for how good the localization needs to be helpful with the follow-up? I mean, it's going from 600 to 300 degrees useful, or maybe you got to 5 degrees before it falls.
Let's have the astronomer sitting next to you actually.
Okay.
I have to say, it increased it to 0.00 every clock. I'm happy with that. It worked with that. The real answer is that it's all same factors. So it's the 23rd magnitude, we can put it straight on this. Didn't happen. The 25th magnitude, we can do much, much better. It's just how much pulse on we can throw that into the world. So if I may, before we go to the cell phone, coming back to Stefan's point, thanks for that one. So if we look at like the 75th percentile, when Virgo's basically off, it's still about 500 square degrees. But in this configuration, it's well below, it's you know maybe 100 square degrees or so. What we might be much more concerned with is what is the impact on the best localized source that I might be able to detect over the time period?
Thank you. And I have a question which is somehow more towards the local side, but we also do a trigger searches where the end signal is found first and the original data. Now, if I got to guess, which are the chances that this is the way we're going to have to find the first neutron, EN, and the additional wave signal? Because the GRB, you know, are pretty far away. It's not unreasonable to think that they have very loud noise, but if we get the GRB first and look after, many times on the Gestilal or our searches will not find the alien cell. So what do you think? Because we not often mention this other way of searching the, in our data in other talks and
That's an original shot. So I would be surprised if that's the first neutron star binary that we found.
No, I mean joints. No, not just.
Oh, yes.
I mean,
dawn detection.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think that operationally for doing multi-wavelength follow-up, it's not going to be all that different versus, you know, doing a search for a kilonova triggered by a light detection, because chances are, just based on sky area, that the first GRB coincidence would be picked up by an all-sky satellite of Fermi. The localization, you know, area on the sky is still going to be quite challenging, and so it's going to require sort of the same type of approach that people have been developing for just following up light sources. But we could get very lucky.
So, very nice talk. So, did you think about looking actually the dollar value on the follow-up observations? So you can actually convert the sky area with dollars.
To dollars?
Yes.
Maybe
like closed money could be the telescope, closed money could take the images. It could be enlightenment. Just look at it.
I don't know how to do that.
Okay.
I mean, most of these facilities are, well, I don't have to do that. I'm sorry.
Can you tell me about the right side of your plot? So it looks like the white dots are going to zero, and I'm impressed by zero.
It seems like there's a really, really small areas on the right side, and maybe a little bit smaller than I would guess. So I'm going to learn something. So you can tell me about what's happening there.
Well, so the right hand set from here to here, we're going from the what's depicted in the observing scenario document for O2 to three equally sensitive levels. And the what you're seeing is that the median localization is going to 10 square degrees or so. That's all that is. That's, I think, borne out by what we've written in the observing scenario document. So, I mean, this exact configuration isn't described here, but if we had three equally sensitive factors, this is what would happen. Subject to caveats about none of this includes calibration uncertainty, so there would be a floor.
You have a question? Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
So Laura asked me to talk about post-O3 scenarios, how upgrades and data taking can be managed for best science, including Virgo and Kagra timeline, expectations on evolution of their sensitivity, and prospects for Laura. Yeah, a very ambitious title. And I will do my best. Some of the discussion that we had this morning were already on some of these items, so I will go quick on things that we already discussed and try to adjust like that. So I guess you all know what the gravitational wave observatories in the world are. Recent successes with approval of LIGO India. So I will go very quickly on this. So the observing plan that both LIGO and Virgo published is the one that we all know very well. In that plan, we were essentially describing status up to O3 with about a 9-month run. And then after that, the assumption was somehow that all the detectors would run at their best for the while. was kind of vague on that. So after Mike talks this morning, the projection for LIGO would look something like this one on slide 4, where we see O1 is the sensitivity achieved. This is the amplitude detector in O1. O2 here assumes a factor of 2 higher power in the arms. O3 is not shown there, but it's in between O3 and O4, where the O4 curve corresponds to advanced LIGO sensitivity at full power. And then the curve that Mike showed this morning corresponding to A plus is what is called O5 there. So that would be a progression, and I've been kind of vague here about round duration for obvious reasons because we don't quite know yet. So this is the LIGO projection. Giovanni already talked a bit about Virgo and the challenges for advanced Virgo. I guess I want to start with the positive message that a couple of months ago, Virgo locked the 3 kilometers arm. Here is a plot. You could see that that's the transmitted power up here, and we achieved a stable lock over hours very, very quickly. So the challenging monolithic suspensions are under investigations, and Giovanni was saying this is a technical problem that will eventually be solved. There is a dedicated facility for this investigation, so commissioning is progressing with steel wires. Of course, Giovanni should jump in anytime he wants, but so the basic assumption right now is Virgo is expected to join O2 early next year and should still meet the minimal early goals defined in advance. Cagra, again, also the positive message first. You know that Cagra recently locked the testbed Michelson interferometer at room temperature. And so that was, to me, very incredible that the whole facility was built so quickly, actually. So this is Shinzia and Masaki providing this updated schedule with the 3 phases, with increasing interferometer complexity in the next year. The most recent schedule is that cryogenic operation would start late 2018, early 2019. And sorry, the red is not very clear, but expected to join observation sometime in early 2020. That's just to give a scale. And I want to say that there is a discussion ongoing with the Calgary collaboration that will happen probably in the fall after discussion within the Calgary collaboration itself would be done. Okay, so this is a very quick projection of what all the major technologies in the world will look like in the future. I want to add LIGO India. This is based on a talk that Fred gave very recently. The main point is that there is a project schedule that is being developed. And this project schedule, I'm sure with many caveats, but it's consistent with observation beginning in January 2024. So that's another data point to our discussion. Based on Leo's talk, I'm trying here to make some very general and therefore not very maybe correct statement, but just to guide the run planning criteria. So given O1 results, my take would be that advanced LIGO 1 sensitivity is benchmarked for detection. And from Leo's conclusions, one could extract this 2 point. The detection rate is set by the range of the second most sensitive detector. And for sky localization, a third detector contributes even if it has a factor of 4 less sensitivity than the most sensitive one. So with this in mind, here is my attempt on slide 9 to try to define what this observing scenario in the next decade might look like. Again, all the caveats that you can imagine, this is mainly up for discussion. So you just go back to John's question. That's why I thought it would be easier to talk about it with this slide in front of us. So here, you see this is the next decade. LIGO H1, LIGO L1, Virgo, Cagra, and LIGO India. And so here, essentially, up to 2018, you would be in the same progression that we've been discussed with O2 and O3. And then when O4 comes, the LIGO detectors would be close to design sensitivity, and Virgo would also be operating at some good sensitivity. We would have a network very close to whatever optimal sensitivity they might have. And then according to the current Cagra timeline, you see Cagra would join something like STAR in 2020 here. And there would be an opportunity for even for the four detector network here. So based on Mike's talk, early 2021, there would be the question of, are we shutting down both LIGO detectors for an A-plus upgrade? Are we doing squeezing and coding at the same time? Those are kind of the question on the table here. And then you see that as we move on, I was assuming that, you know, Virgo and Cagra, as they're starting and catching up a lower sensitivity, they might need extra commissioning time to improve their sensitivity. You know, so for Cagra, they are likely that we come up online at the best of, all this happens. And then LIGO India starts to play later in the game. And then here, what I call O5 would be it's kind of different with respect to the O5 that you've seen before, because now with the A plus upgrade, this O5 would mean we're operating the LIGO detector that maybe a factor of two better sensitivity than before. That's essentially the plan. Of course, I'm not trying to predict too much beyond a decade, but at this point here, when LIGO India comes online, one could see that we would have options for turning off the detectors at the point we have a network of five. Okay, so I think we can come back on this slide later for the questions. So, but in the next one, I was Albert actually suggested that to make the discussion a little bit more practical, it would be good to try to compare different options. And so here what I'm plotting is on the x-axis the calendar year, so from 2016 to 2026, on the vertical axis is volume times time in units of O1. And so I'm just here trying to make the point that so this blue curve is what would happen if we were just keep running at O2 sensitivity without doing any upgrade and using the LIGO detector here as an example. And so by 2026, you would have 45 times the volume time that we had in O1. I'm using DNS ranges, and all very quickly we all move to DBH, but this is still the point is the same thing to do it for DBH. So then the red curve here is what happens if you do what is now the baseline assumption in the observing scenario document, meaning you do O2, O3, and then starting from O4, we just run at advanced LIGO design sensitivity. So every time there is an increase, here is O2, this is O3, this is O4, and then for advanced LIGO, O4, we just keep going like this. And now the other two curves, the gray and the green, are the two scenarios in which we do an A-plus upgrade, either serial or parallel. So in the gray trace, we do a serial upgrade. We put one detector down for upgrade, and then we do the other. This is the approach that Mike doesn't like for a good reason, because you always gain, obviously, during the at the very beginning, but then in the course of a few years of observing, there is about a factor of two difference in the volume time that you can call. So this is just a toy to make the point that. Yeah. So the assumption here is that in the gray curve, thank you for reminding this point. Here the assumption is The third detector is running at a good sensitivity. And here I'm using a 3/4 of the advanced LIGO sensitivity. So the gray curve relies entirely on either Hugo or Kadra at that point to run for detection in conjunction with one of the LIGO detectors. Thank you for reminding that. Okay. Yeah, we can come back to this as well. Here I have just some messages. I'm not sure if the messages are more additional, maybe discussion point. So based on what we have said today, my take on it, the expectation is we'll try to maximize coincidence across the network in the next few years for improved sky localization. And I guess the option of doing something different, we will have it only when Virgo and Kagra will have a LIGO 01-like sensitivity. I think we all agree on that. Regarding an A-plus upgrade, the maximize, the maximum scientific output is done when we're going to upgrade in parallel at both sites. Obviously, as we were discussing earlier, I'm just using volume time as theory of merit. There are also ISNR events and other things, but just to be the case. A serial upgrade, meaning we do the two LIGO detectors sequentially, would rely entirely on Virgo and Kagra for detection, as Gabby was highlighting. The other point is that that emerged in the discussion this morning, that the same A-plus technologies offer enhancement opportunities for the entire network. And so Virgo and Kagra are already developing squeezing, and they have a strong squeezing R&D programs. If you have a better coating that works for LIGO, certainly it works for Virgo as well. Okay, the next slide is about LIGO India. Also, this was mentioned this morning. I think it's kind of obvious when we put together the timeline that LIGO India should plan now for a fast progression toward an A-plus detector. And try to incorporate early plans for filter cavity infrastructure, at least make sure that the filter cavity retrofit is easy, and leverage on progressing coating research for A-plus. And then this is the last point I want to make, is that when we have LIGO India, that will add flexibility to the network for a major Voyager-like update. At that point, it would be the 5 detectors in the world working. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Based on slide 10, where the volume is neutron star volumes.
Yeah. As I was saying, in DNS, if you do the same for BDH, the absolute numbers are different, but the message that you get from the picture is different.
Yes, still on the slide and on the previous one, I think that really, if you do a parallel upgrade to a class to gain in terms of volume of time, but you lose in terms of network.
Yeah.
So a serial approach could have the advantage, provided that the little tracker will be up to induce sensitivity, a serial approach should be considered in terms of having always three detectors.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why here there is, fortunately, that was a poor choice, but there is a decision point there, which we say, both LIGO sites simultaneously or not, then I think obviously not. But
yeah,
this, it will be based on what we see in 04, and I think during 04, there will be a thing which we already have a network running. So I guess if we see that there are many finite neutron stars out there and we want to see them, that's a discussion that we need to have.
I just don't understand this point. Once we're in the regime of one detection per day, who really cares if we go down for 3 days?
Sorry, kick me a bit.
Oh, Donna was saying, if we are in a region where we see a detection today, who cares if we go down for a while? Probably.
That was answering that.
I think we should pay the big expectation, the detection for day. I think it's not as big, quite a big case, because the next day. I mean, even if you count, you have to multiply with numbers, but
yeah.
For one detection.
Well, yeah, and 2.5 black holes, zero. Well,
I'm saying that we shouldn't count in one detection day. At least the second one. You?
I'm a little worried by seeing parts on this plot for all the detectors. What is our plan for supernova?
No, I didn't put it in dashnally. I think other people might have stronger.
When I have a somewhat provocative answer, and I'm just saying it to the. Give a counterpoint, which will be overruled immediately. I think that if you know what you can do to improve your detector, right, any given detector, whether it's the best detector you have, the second best, the fourth best, or whatever, you should probably improve your detector. I think that it's a silly gamble to leave a detector that has known defects or could be improved running on the off chance we have a 100 years miracle, because you're letting actual science fall on the floor by not improving that. So I think you have to think about it rationally from that standpoint. It's like, do you take your food money and buy lateral, right? That's sort of all that is. If you don't know how to improve your detector, right, and you don't get where your funding window or something like that, then you have to keep the funding.
I want to add something to Mike's statement. In fact, the more I hear of this discussion, the more I worry about it. I don't like this. This is sort of the supermarket approach to the whole field. It's crazy, but I think it's not. It's going to use B times T as the question. It's going to be the science that you learn from the fire bus that will drive you to what you want to do. I think you're going to have this kind of setting. I don't know how often, but you can't set a policy. Because, first of all, you're going to probably find that, not that it gets warm, but you're going to ask questions that say, look, here, it'd be very interesting to know, is there a gap? And we'll talk more about this tomorrow, but in the gap of the black hole mass spectrum, if you get to a Z of a certain distance, because it says something about the production of energy. So it isn't the number, it's sometimes the quality of what you're looking for. That's going to determine whether you want to go in a specific direction. And it's the same thing, I'm fully expecting that this field would be almost not impressive if this field didn't discover things you didn't understand. I mean, we keep saying that, we said that many, many years ago, but that's going to be probably the thing that's going to drive a lot of your decisions. You have something you do not understand, and then you want to see maybe more of it, but ultimately, the way you want to do it is you want to see it with that decision you make. So it's going to be a decision that you have to make on, and you have to do it continuously. You can't use this meat market approach.
Okay. I don't think we disagree. This is actually going exactly in the same direction. Go in the same direction.
Because some bureaucrat will use that. So that I in Congress. Well, that's the kind of measure that a jerk could use.
This plot wants just to make the point that every time you can improve a detector, you should do it. That's all.
It's related to that. It's also the what you've learned in the prior period. Very important.
I think we all agree with that. Science will make a change with that, and that's why we should keep having it for perhaps 100 years. But this is only the second thing. but I think even unrelated to it, I didn't plan for this, but planning is essential. something we do, you know, even for HF, that's only there in 2012, we need to do that now. So,
can I add something to it?
So I think these planning exercises is not used yet. You said it's okay.
I'm not disagreeing with you, Gabi, but let me add something to it. So I would, if you're going to carry this metric of V times T, I also want to carry another thing, the number of new discoveries you make. That's the other line that you want to carry.
Give me a functional form of what?
Just another thing. That's a perfect
number.
What new things have you discovered? And then you get, from that, you can get an idea of your operating problem.
So I think that this is purely a multi-objective optimization problem, and I think that volume times time and distance are both important, and volume times time will remain important until we detect the first example of any particular rare extragalactic population, such as neutron star background images, or eccentric binary black hole, or pick something else that we don't think that we'll see very regularly. So I do also see that you know, the pitfall, potential pitfall of only showing that part. And so it would be nice to have a similar sort of trajectory for the disk, the range function time. And then, you know, also, since I'm interested in both messenger stuff, something like that for localization is a function of
time.
Let me just say that for broadband improvement, just generally, would be like almost any source you can think of, first can be detected return by logging this time. But it's a good metric for most things. And sure, it's a little bit different depending on the spectrum as well. But a lot of things for broadband improvement, that's really the right one. But it's hard to come up with a quantitative measure, which is better than volume. I wasn't joking, it's going to be a function form. You can say, I want it to be new science stuff. I want the number of citations of function time. I mean, sure, good luck with writing that function, but it's very hard to do this.
Well, this is in the same vein as what Adam and Leo just said. I mean, there's a principle that the most interesting things are always going to be marginal in signal to noise. Now, we got out of that with the first one, right? But if you took away 1509.14, right, where would we be in terms of, well, we're at the limits of the sensitivity, the instruments sort of just barely squeaking by with a confirmed detection, and almost, that's going to be a more difficult situation in the future with any new kind of phenomenon we pick up. You have to anticipate what your mindset is going to be. You need more sensitivity. You need a better signal-to-noise ratio. If you pick up anything that's unusual or unprecedented, you have to basically think about not only the sum total of all the integrated events within your horizon right now, but exactly what's happening at your horizon.
Peter Lende.
Yeah, but you guys, you know, there isn't just a universal definition of volume, right? You're going to use the right volume if you're going to argue that way. And there's some dependence on mass, and there's not a big dependence for a lot of the space. But, you know, for some science that you might think of where you're trying to get parameter estimation out or where you need to localize it within, I don't know, 5 square degrees to a certain type of follow-up or something like that, you know, this universal scaling, which way to, you know, doesn't scale in any way. And so I don't know what the exact answer is, but in principle, there are scientific questions that you would need to address by pushing in some different directions than just scaling the overall sensitivity. And
Dave,
doing this particular volume measure.
Dave?
So the point that Ray made was interesting. I want to follow up on it. Go back to discussions that I had in the past, people have grown and so it comes back to the super information. Right? It is a lot of information. On the other hand, it satisfies the new science criteria pretty dramatically. Right? So in the past, we always had this attitude, well, we need to run the geo running, you know, because you know, this is super algorithm, the AI is best. We don't know what this plot is going to look like first. That's a good It's a good starting point, but it's going to be hard. If we have five detectors running from the car, doesn't make sense to have at least one running all the time. Would anybody dispute that?
I mean, every time doesn't come quickly all the time.
Sure, but that's okay. If you could fix that problem, it's great, but control down.
It depends. Instead of, yeah, that was my question.
I lost track of my name.
Well, Mike lost
his name. Mike and then you went directly. Mike, yeah.
Yeah, it's like I say, instead of what? If you have no option to improve a detector, right, then it probably makes sense. But if it's your worst detector and it has a very low chance of, you know, of paying anything off, then you're operating it, right? You're incurring that cost without actually getting continuous sign of benefit, which you could if you improve it. So, but I think.
And now shut up. I mean, I think there is a science question in the sense that I think all of these detectors that we're looking at now cannot get out of the galaxy as far as the supernovas, right? Right? So, okay, it's not until you get the Voyager, or not Voyager, Cosmic Explorer, that you get into Andromeda and other galaxies, so the rates start to go up dramatically. I guess what I'm saying is for the next 15 years, maybe if you want to see a supernova, you've got to. 15-year period, that's the point.
So, Dave, I don't think there is no dramatic. I don't think there's a dramatic. It might get to
Cosmic Explorer.
Yeah, even at that level, one per year. Because until you reach 15 to 20 megaparsec distance, the universe is almost empty. Okay, so at 5 megaparsec, it will be one per year, put a greater than. But we have three orders of magnitude uncertainty in the energy. So it could be a year or later, depending on that. But that number, one per year, might be, you know, 5 megaparsec reach is for Cosmic Explorer at the best of the energy and in the middle of the energy.
Okay, two more questions and then we'll break for coffee.
So I just want to go back to a point I made in the morning, which is and very relevant to the discussion. So Lisa's done a very nice job of pulling this together and shows how different things can interact in that one metric that we're using. We need to come up to drive our future discussions with a set of metrics. It cannot be 20. Because nobody can think in 20 dimensions, but it probably needs to be 3 or 4 that we use for future planning. And I would guess one has to include a different spectrum, something that doesn't run as high as the bucket, you know, that lower mass region. And I think a challenge is for the people who do parameter estimation to also, you know, try to come up with some sort of a metric from a parameter estimation point of view of where that good science lies. I think if you're looking for unexpected stuff, neutron star volume versus time is a good metric, actually. So it's as broad as anything else.
I mean,
well, anyway, my point is it's just a challenge.
But I don't understand your point because the volume time metric goes in the same direction that you want your metric to go. You're going the same direction. Every time you can improve the instrument, you improve it. That's essentially the only point of that law. So don't get attached to the volume time.
You want the wait time. Volume time, stop time. Right. One last comment and then we'll drink more coffee. Okay.
Yeah.
Also along the lines of metrics that emphasize precision science on individual objects, I think that we also need to keep in mind the floor that's set by televisions, and so that's an important part of the metrics, not directly accounted for by churning the noise curve through some problem.
Okay.
And that's the last one.
A while ago, I had a chat with people in the research group about this, and they told me that by then, the ESPEC would be at the technical limit that comes from the NIST, so the laser itself is below 1%, you know, so you can believe it. I'm reporting.
All right, I say we break for coffee. 4 p.m.